Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson. You know, if you want to know where you're headed, you have to know where you are and where you've been. Well, continuing with our annual tradition, we've got the best year-end review in the business, thanks to today's guest, Dave Collum. And for those of you unfamiliar with Dave, he's a professor of chemistry and chemical biology at Cornell University, obviously the perfect guy to talk to us about macroeconomics. And in addition to his academic interests, Dave authors an annual macroeconomic assessment titled The Year in Review and is hands down the best synopsis of anything that mattered during the previous 12 months. And Dave's latest year in review can once again be found on peakprosperity.com. And I'm excited to have him with us now live in order to expand on his excellent insights. Hey, Dave, thanks so much for joining us again this year.
It's great to be here. I enjoy your podcast more than anything else I do.
Oh, thank you so much for that. Well, you know, before we jump into the macro, let me go micro for a second. The Fed just came out with a taper announcement, and they're going from $85 to $75 billion a month, ostensibly, although, as you and I have noted in the past, if you actually look at the Fed's expansion of its balance sheet, it's been running a little over $90 billion a month for the past year, so who knows where the $85 billion a month number comes from. And what did we see in response? Well, stocks are vaulting higher, bonds are vaulting higher, gold is subdued. This is just, can you help us make sense at all of what the market is thinking, and I have to put quotes around that word here, thinking at this juncture?
The answer is no, I can't help you with that. You could actually take a trite stance and say, look, that's a buy the rumor, that's a buy the rumor, sell the news, or sell the rumor, buy the news moment, right? So to the extent they're afraid of the taper, now they're not afraid of the taper, and so they buy, right? It's something that's silly, but we're still $75 billion away from zero, and if we got rid of the entire taper, we're still at unprecedentedly low Fed funds rate. So it appears as though we have, taken out, 5% of some tumor embedded in the monetary system. So it's hard for me to get excited about it. But otherwise, I think what you're seeing is market behavior that's based on, that has a kind of a turbulence to it that's what you would expect and call rational only in the context of massive monetary printing causing money to slosh around wildly, right?
Well, I feel like you and I are this is going to be a challenging podcast because we've been handed a rubber yardstick and we're in a hall of mirrors and people are asking us to give them something firm that they can look at and make sense of. And this is really, if this year in review, if I was going to sort of scan through your list of things that I've read, it's not so much a case of, here are the really, truly exceptional things that really, happened. We didn't have a Lehman collapse this year. We didn't have certain things besides, I guess Snowden's big revelations on the NSA. What we really have are just continued distortions. And they're so distorted now at this point that many of the things that you've cataloged are, to me, just come across as literally like a funhouse of mirrors. They're so distorted at this point, most people can't even recognize them as distorted any longer. And we've been living under fairly grotesque conditions for quite a while now, financially. So where do we start with all of this? Let's start right in with where you think the stock market is and whether you've seen a market that smells, tastes, and feels like this one before, and what's propping it up here?
There's a lot of measurements out there that are truly unbelievable. You'll read about the housing recoveries in full force, and then you actually look at it and say, wait a minute, I can't even detect it on a plot. And earnings fall into that particular category. So there is a massive distortion of earnings. I was just listening to some this morning where they kept talking about how, earnings jumped, and then they say, but that's due to share buyback. So now you have, major corporations that instead of putting their capital, which in my opinion is largely borrowed, but instead of putting it into capital expenses, which would grow the business. This year's capex is approximately zero, right? So we're eating our seed corn this year. We're not doing a lot of R&D according to the numbers. We're putting it into share buybacks. You know, even a company like Merck did that. So their pipeline looks like it dried up in their responses to buyback shares. And that makes no sense. But then you get into the guts of the earnings. And you've got two problems there. One is, Stockman estimated, that the X items, where they keep doing these one-off items, which turn out to occur in every earnings report every quarter, he estimated that might be causing as much of a 30% distortion of the earnings to the upside. And then the second trick that they do is they use forward earnings. And I got into a spat with some prominent bull. And I said, you know, so he used forward earnings, and I said, well, why would you use those? They're the only ones that don't exist, right? They're fictional. They're being fabricated. And it's also well documented that as the earnings come in, the forward estimates start dropping down as reality strikes. And then they get to the point they're so low that they start using the next year's forward earnings. And I think the forward earnings estimates are another, you know, double-digit percent contribution to distorting the so-called earnings, the so-called P.E. ratio. So some guy will go on TV and say the P.E. ratio is 15. I think it could be 25. You got the Case-Shiller P.E. that's sitting at 24, which is nosebleed. And they use, you know, trailing earnings. You use trailing earnings. The Russell 2000 is something like 60 or 70. I mean, it's a disaster. So I think we're getting bad read on earnings, and I think that elevates the market. And I think the day traders, the algos, they're bidding up the market with easy money. And so this won badly, but I don't know when. Timescale, who knows? We're back into the land of the insane.
Well, there are a couple things that have legitimately boosted corporate earnings. One is they're not paying workers. Famously, you've got McDonald's and Walmart, whose business model and corporate profits almost entirely depend on the taxpayer providing their workers with food and medicine and things like that, and basic living things. And but in truth, and the second thing that's really boosting corporate earnings right now is that they're feasting on the lowest ever cost of capital. And what's interesting to me is what you mentioned, CapEx, the capital expenditures. That's the reinvestment in your productive property, plant, and equipment. That's investing in your R&D pipeline. That's building your company back up and investing for the future, is at all-time lows. While money is at an all-time cheap position, and so what are corporations doing with all that cheap money that they're getting? Well, they're buying back shares, which tends to boost earnings per share. So that when you look at the debt side of the equation on corporations, they've actually been levering up pretty handily, and so that makes sense, I guess. But at the same time, anybody who's projecting that all-time historical high corporate earnings, like as we look at corporate profits as a percent of GDP, they're at the highest they've been in 70 years, and I don't think they've been higher. And the idea that they would then stay there, that permanently high plateau of prosperity, where have I heard that before?
Irving Fisher. Let's stick on that idea for a minute, because it could be confused. So you say, well, we're at record high corporate earnings, and you say, well, of course, because we have a growing economy. But we're at record high profit margins, right? And that's a plot I know you know, and I think you were referring to. And profit margins are one of the most regressible measures out there. And that is, when your profit margins are at record high, they are going to regress back to the mean. And what I can tell you is, if your profit margins cut in half, which is easy to do, it's hard to cut your total earnings in half, but your profit margins, they cut. Next thing you know, you've got no earnings, right? Next thing you know, and they tend to arbitrage away. So being at record high profit margins is decidedly bearish. There's no way of looking at it any other way, because you are going to regress to normal profit margins. And as you said, they're getting it off of free money. They're getting it off of CapEx light investing. They're not putting money into plant and hardware and R&D. And so they're basically just taking all profit right now, right here in the present. And they're not paying, you know, so that we got workers going on temp status, and so they don't have to pay, you know, health benefits. And oh my God, that'll take us into Obamacare in a heartbeat there. And so it's optimum for profit margins, and that will regress. Not only to the mean, it will regress through the mean, because otherwise you don't have a mean. So.
Yep. Well, the idea that we're going to permanently live at these corporate profit margins is a really bizarre idea, and one that doesn't have a lot of data to back it up. But that's what you get when you're in a bubble. I'm a big fan of thinking we're in the largest liquidity-driven bubble ever. And by the way, if we widen the lens a little bit, we discover this isn't a U.S. story. I'm not talking about U.S. stocks only here. The German DAX is in the same sort of territory. Even the Greek stock market has recovered against every possible underlying economic statistic, right? So with that, you know, we have to just adjust to the idea that we are living in an incredible liquidity-fueled abundance at this point in time. And the part that's just starting to sneak through, this is the interesting development for me this year, the part that's starting to sneak through is awareness that regime of flooding the world with liquidity has not floated all boats. In fact, not even the majority of boats. In fact, not even 10% of the boats. In fact, you could even argue that the 1% versus the 99%, yeah, it really lifted the 1%'s boats. But within the 1%, the fraction of that, the 0.1%, they really got their boats lifted. That this was an absolutely regressive, repressive, and deeply unfair, if I can use a qualitative term like that, a deeply unfair sort of way to go about trying to boost things, as it were.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to give the Fed a little bit of credit in the sense that I don't think they saw that coming. If they did, we should just line them up and hang them because you're right, it's unfair. I think they actually believed that they could pump money into the system and it would pump it somehow into the economy. I don't get this, right? You and I talk about this every year about how you can't print your way to prosperity. And in fact, if you know, you say, okay, let's go back and look at the historical record. Who has printed their way? Who has inflated their way to prosperity? And that list has not yet been uploaded to the internet. Okay, that's a list yep. of zero right now. Yep. And so they're doing highly experimental things. I view the unfairness of it is almost antiseptically in the sense that it's not about redistributing wealth. So as soon as you start talking about unfair, people start saying, oh boy, you know, now you're going to try to take it away and you're going to start putting in high taxes and all this stuff. No, I think a healthy economy naturally distributes wealth in a rational way. And I can't say it's a simple way, and I can't say I even know what it is. But my sense is that when economy is really chugging along efficiently, that wealth will spread out various ways and the rich will get richer. I mean, there's no question that's true, but everyone else will get their share of the pie. Not happening right now. And history shows that when you have the masses getting pounded, forget about whether it's fair or not or whether you redistribute it or not, bad things happen, right? And if you tell those masses, you know, let them eat cake, the next move is not a pleasant one. So that's my view. I think we should worry about the unfairness from a purely pragmatic perspective, and that is that civil unrest is what follows.
Well, we've already seen that, of course, in certain municipalities that have collapsed where somehow there just wasn't enough juice to keep the whole thing going. Camden, New Jersey pops to mind, Detroit, you know, certain suburbs of other major cities and urban areas. So we see that already there's sort of a decaying going on. And this is the thing that gets me is just the short-sightedness, both on the fiscal side out of D.C. and the monetary side on the Fed. You know, to give you, you know, you spotted the Fed credit and said, you know, well, maybe they didn't know how this was really going to turn out. And they thought that if they could just goose the markets and boost asset prices, you know, they famously still confuse rising asset prices with wealth. And so go ahead, they do that. They didn't really see this coming. But how? What are we? We're going on our seventh year of this at this point in time, and we can arguably look out and say there's no organic growth really coming up that's going to lift us out of this. You know, the idea that, you know, people are familiar with the headline numbers that unemployment seems to be falling, but a lot of that is statistical fudgery, and honestly, it's so dishonest. I don't even know where to begin on that. And our economy is ostensibly growing a little bit, but it's not growing at all if you factor out deficit spending by the federal government, which is completely enabled by debt monetization by the Fed. Once we factor those things out, we say, look, there isn't real growth in the economy yet still. So that brings us to sort of like having our own Japan moment. And you have one line. You had a bunch of great lines in your year-end review. This is one that actually made me chuckle out loud. I love this one. You said, Japan's 24-year-old lost decade is often attributed to inadequate intervention by central bankers and policymakers insufficiently armed with untested theories of academic economists mired in state capitalism.
It's a mouthful.
Untested theories of academic economists mired in state capitalism. Well, here we are entering our seventh year of state capitalism. What kind of a grade can we give the Fed for perspicacity, forecasting, and responsiveness?
Well, I give them an F, but I give them an F. I give them a Hayekian F is what I give them. And that is what they suffer from is the fatal conceit that Hayek titled one of his books. And you know, I talked to an economist at Cornell who I have no axe to grind, but I asked her, I said, you know, when in your economics education do you learn about the history of economics? When do you get the historical backdrop? And I bet you there's economists in major economic departments who have not read The Wealth of Nations, for example. I bet they're out there. And she said to me, she said, well, I took a course in economic history. And I'm thinking, you took a course? So my definition of economics is really ultra simple. The question you say is, we've been here before, what happened next, right? That's it. That to me is economics. And the problem is, you got all these computer, mathematically driven economists, and I think they're losing the perspective of what really got us here. And they've got their models and they've got their math, but they're forgetting about the fact that, you know, Bitcoin, I'm gonna really irritate the Bitcoin crowd out there. I'm sympathetic to why they like Bitcoin, but it's up 90-fold. That's a tulip mania, right? And you know, there were things that people referred to metaphorically as tulip mania, but Bitcoin is tulip mania in all its magnitude, tulip mania.
Mm-hmm.
So in any event, so the Fed somehow thinks that they can set the price of capital. Now, I know of no market in the world more important, and I know of no mechanism more important than price discovery, yet the Fed takes this system that's attempting to equilibrate, that's attempting to get the borrowers and the lenders together and say, okay, what price is capital? And the Fed is saying, no, you're wrong. We know better. Here is what it should be to optimize mm-hmm. the system. And that is a fatal conceit. That is a kind of an arrogance that I can't get my brain. If they were biologists, they would be redesigning the damn elephant. They'd be saying it's too fat, they'd take away its trunk, they'd make its legs longer, right? Ignoring the fact that billions of years of evolution created this miracle. And so that's where I blame the Fed, is they don't even understand that they shouldn't be using price controls. And by the way, everyone acts shocked that capital is worth zero. That my hard-earned savings, I've saved aggressively through the years, and it's now worth zero because the Fed has decided to feed the system all the capital it wants. So some guy wants to borrow from me, he simply borrows from the system now. And that's not fair. That's what intervention in the capital markets does. It renders my capital worthless, and that makes me kind of irritated.
Well, for you, it's an irritation, but for people who are living on fixed incomes, it's absolutely deadly, and that's really where we're at. And of course, you know, the other fatal flaw of the Fed, and I completely agree. I read hubris all over these people. They've looked into their little models, and I was at this conference a while back, and I think Jim Rickards had it right. He said they run their models perfectly. The only problem is their models are all wrong. And so you can get perfect outputs, but if your model's wrong, you're still going to get bad results. And so they're running their models. They're dutifully cranking them. And, you know, for me, even if they had the right economic models, even if they had something more in the Austrian version that understood you can't get a free lunch and you can't print prosperity, even if they were operating that model well, they still don't seem to have any inputs coming in from the natural world in terms of actual limits, in terms of how much energy is, how much it's going to cost now, the fact that, you know, net energy is declining, the fact that, you know, the seas are basically stripped clean of protein at this point in time, whatever those other things are we might want to look at. The Fed is completely unaware of those. So let's just drop with them into their world. They're running their system. They're turning their cranks. They have to. Don't you think that, at some level they have a gut fear over the fact that real robust growth hasn't happened?
Yeah. One of the sections I write about, I don't know if you want to go there now or later, but you can make the case that from statements made by guys at the BIS and the World Bank and the IMF and the Troika, you know, that they actually realize that the system is heading for a big reset. There's statements that they've made about how, you know, the way they bailed out Cyprus in a completely ham-fisted way, that they realize that the system is going to go through an upheaving, sort of cataclysmic shaking of the Etch-a-Sketch, and that they're trying to figure out how to survive that. And it's a high probability view of what they're thinking. I don't know, but there is some arithmetic nonsense out there. I did a little bit of math, for example, on the unfunded liabilities, and I bounced this off Kotlikoff, and he seemed to like, you never know, he might be humoring me, but in which I took the $200 trillion of unfunded liabilities. These are the promises we've made, subtracting away projected revenues. That's a key distinction. And it's the promises that we simply don't have a clue how we're going to pay for them. And you project them out to infinity, right? So you say, okay, based on all the promises we've made now, it kind of tapers off. You say, well, that therefore confuses me. So I say, let's demonetize this. So I take the $200 trillion, which he confirmed as little as 2 weeks ago, and I say, okay, there's about 100 million taxpayers, and on average they earn about $50,000. And so I start dividing through, and then I say, what happens if the average taxpayer commits half of their salary, $25,000 of their salary, to pay off these unfunded liabilities? How many years do they have to do this? And the answer is a staggering 80 years. And therefore, it's nonsense. The payback rate, the payoff rate, the amortization rate is nonsense. But even with that aggressive one, it's 80 years, a lifetime. And so therefore, they're not going to be paid off. There is no mechanism for payoff. They can't. Let's say Kotlikoff's off. I've seen estimates as low as $70 trillion. That gets you down to a 25-year payoff time, right? That's still the land of unicorns and Skittles rainbows, right? That's nuts. So the bottom line is these promises are going to be welched on, and we're either going to inflate them away, and it's going to be one of these things where sure, take all the money you want because it's worthless, or we're just going to default on them. And by the way, the Cyprus bail-in looks like a deflationary default mechanism they're testing. That's what my read on Cyprus is. That's a deflation.
Well, now let's check that out, because the thesis you've got running here is that A, they know that the numbers don't line up and that there's some sort of a reset event. Whether that's inflationary or deflationary is still kind of an open question. We know that they, again, air quotes around that, the word they, would really prefer an inflationary outcome, particularly one that's sort of at a medium hot level. That sort of somehow in their models cures most of the ills and most people can't detect it, and so you get away with it and that's fine. But really what we have here is a case of who's going to take the losses? That's the question du jour. And they started to answer that question, I think, in Cyprus, which for the people listening who somehow aren't familiar with Cyprus, was a case where the banking system was bust, and they decided to tag the depositors in the banking system as the people who should eat the losses in this particular case. And this, you know, they tried to pin it on Russian oligarchs, you know, skirting, financial rules or something like that. But in truth, the Orthodox Church of Cyprus lost quite a bit of money in this little fiasco. So there was this little island nation. You could put a ring fence around it. They thought they could control the whole thing and run a little test petri dish and say, what happens when we do a bail-in? And the first thing is, you can't even shut down the banking system in a tiny island nation without the holes and crevices appearing all over the place, because it turned out... So that's kind of an intriguing thing. But then I saw that the rule sets for banking and how banks would survive another Cyprus-like crisis included bail-ins. And bail-in language has been included in FDIC documents and in Canadian banking documents and in New Zealand banking documents that I've seen. So do you think, you know, that's the model?
Well, so that's why I think that Cyprus is the story below the story. I'm always talking about the Michael Lewis narrative, and beneath the surface, Cyprus is a huge story still, because I think it is a beta test. And when I talk about prominent people, I'm talking about major central banker type size players who are talking about how this bail-in model, they say, we don't want to charge the taxpayer, so we're going to take depositor money. I'm going, who do you think is paying taxes? But the guys with the deposits, right? So it's this fictional distinction. And it doesn't even matter if you had your money in a valid, solvent bank, you still got gutted like a fish. Do you know what the final percentage was, by the way?
No.
I've seen numbers all over the place.
No.
Final. I've heard up to 90, but that sounds high.
Yeah, it was more than 40. I thought it was, my guess would be it averaged in around 60, but I would really have to check that number to be sure, because I never got a final print on that.
But I've cited a bunch of instances of players saying, we like this model. Now, if you start confiscating bank accounts, I think that's a deflationary model. I think if you sort of follow the bouncing ball on that, you go, that's deflationary. And why would they play with that? Well, one of the possibilities is the Bernanke and these guys recognize that the inflationary model's failing because they're creating socially unacceptable bubbles. And they can't seem to just get the inflation to go where they want, which anyone who knows about inflation knows that's exactly the problem, right? You release inflation, you don't get to direct it. And they are getting these effects that are going to lead to civil unrest, and they know that sort of thing. And so there was this very scary article that was in Zero Hedge just the other day where the IMF declared to Zero Hedge that they were wrong about a one-time hit to global bank accounts. And Zero Hedge went right back at him and said, here's your words, dudes. And there's no question that the IMF basically came out and said, if we hit them hard, fast, and once, people will just dust themselves off and move on. And that's, I don't want to be in a banking system that does that.
Well, this is the big mystery to me because Cyprus was clearly and obviously both a test case and a PR campaign. I watched carefully how it was sort of packaged and sold for consumption, and there was a little wild wooliness around the edges. I don't think they had the story completely contained very well, but it was clearly a trial run, and that's all you have to tell me. The idea that people would leave their money in the system after that is just startling to me, because these are...
So here's the problem, though. I've got a huge amount of sheltered accounts. Right, a lot of my wealth is in 401k, IRA, SEP IRA, you know, employer-based accounts.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is, what do I do? That money's a sitting duck. They've locked the doors to the casino, and now they're lighting it on fire. Right, this is high risk stuff. And so I didn't do it this year, but I'm thinking about stopping contributions to all sheltered accounts, because I've heard discussions of capping them. You say, okay, if they want to tell me I've got too much, I can't add anymore, I'm fine by that. But if they say you've got too much, we're taking it, that gets real problematic. And there was another reference to the to an IRA and retirement accounts as an annuity, which means do what you want, but when you die, it's gone. That the word annuity should scare the hell out of your heirs, and if you care about having heirs. And so there's been a lot of this kind of chatter that tells me that confiscation of retirement money is on their radar.
Well,
and I'm a lot in there, and I'm not quite sure how to handle this. But if I take it all out at once, I take it out at the marginal rate, I get crushed. It's a very expensive put option I'm buying if I do it.
One of my operating principles, and I have several, and one of our operating principles at Peak Prosperity is that when circumstances call for it, they'll just change the rules. So here's how you line up the dots. A, the system is structurally insolvent from just a pension and entitlement standpoint, but looking at the fact that we've been increasing debts at a rate roughly twice the rate of underlying even nominal GDP growth, and we want to keep doing that. That's the system that the Fed is attempting to preserve with all of the entitlements and flows of money that go to certain preferred individuals and institutions and, you know, things like that. That's a fundamentally non-sustainable system anyway. And then when we wander over and look at the various ways in which we've gone about at the official level thinking how we're going to deal with crises, I have to give an F on this one because it always felt wrong to me. So the bondholders don't take the hit. The people who took the risk don't take the hit. It always gets foisted off on the taxpayer and then depositors. But these are fundamentally innocent parties as far as I'm concerned, given you know, what actually caused the transgressions in the first place. And through all of that, I am 100% convinced that when the time comes, just like Willie Sutton robbed banks because that's where the money was, that when the time comes, the government will go after the pools of places where there is enough identifiable wealth to figure out where the losses are going to be eaten. And so there, you just look at your pyramid of financial assets. Money market funds are an obvious target. Certain pension holdings are obvious targets, particularly if you can strip them for assets and put IOUs back in their place. There's all kinds of things that can be done. And that's a few things we did see this year. We did see, what was it? Ireland did a one-time, I'm putting air quotes up again, attachment of 0.9% on all pension assets to, you know, help balance out the national budget over there, I believe. So this is the theme, and this confiscatory regime that's sort of been put in, you know, we'll take it if we need it. So look at me with the timing in this. Cyprus comes through, and it was just shortly after that the biggest raid on gold and silver happened. And it just struck me as just too cute by half that the response, quote unquote, of the market to seeing the Cyprus story would be to sell out of the assets that give you your best and, as far as I know, only monetary protection from confiscation of assets that are tucked within a banking system.
As you know, this year you mentioned gold. That's about a 4-hour podcast right there. Gold's price and the behavior of physical gold in the global marketplace were absolutely unconnected this year. And it may sound like a disgruntled gold bug, but absolutely every shred of information out there says that there was a massive spike in physical demand for gold this year. You can track it using official sources. You can track it. It all got pulled out of all the depositories. It got pulled out of GLD. The things the Indian authorities were doing to keep Indians from buying gold in the shut. They were going to go after the religious organizations' gold, and you know, they took Cyprus's gold, and yet so all the evidence points to the fact that there was a huge grab for physical gold. Meanwhile, the price of gold dropped the whole way. And I can't even reconcile those two unless you want to say that the futures market and the physical market have just become completely disconnected. And the way that would happen would be if as you sort of the phrase you use, if the seller in the futures market was a price insensitive seller. Clearly a bear raid, though. I mean, this year was a bear raid in gold. It wasn't just skittish sellers. It was a raid. It was set up, teed up. Someone really took a swipe at gold. And it happened all year long, best I can tell.
Well, certainly. And we saw that in the tape. It's completely obvious if the CFTC ever wanted to do a little investigation, all they would really have to do is look at any one of probably 20 or 30 separate raids that I saw this year, where somebody would come into the overnight markets, very thinly traded, and dump several thousand contracts, typically in a single blast. And we saw that even just in the last few weeks where the gold market had to be halted. Interestingly, once to the upside, too, out of many, many, many examples to the downside. But regardless of who is doing this and their motivations for doing it, we can clearly look at an event where market participants, one or more, come in and just crush the bid structure. That's just blatant price manipulation. That all of those events happen to be to the downside, that strikes me as just a little too cute by half, given what we just saw with Cyprus and looming issues around confiscation.
Well, the other one that jumped out at me, which left me slack-jawed, was when Goldman came out and said, in a public forum, said, short gold. Now, mm-hmm. I have no recollection of any major brokerage coming out and recommending a short position in any asset class. When they don't like something, they say we'd thin up, we'd lighten up, we'd underweight this. I've never mm-hmm. heard a brokerage come out and say short it. They said short it. There was 2 days of relative calm, and then 2 days after they did that, there was this $40, $50, $60 monkey hammering of gold, which, by the way, tens of billions of dollars worth of selling occurred in minutes. Billions in the sub-second range. So this is not skittish investors. Someone's in there banging the gold price that day, and then they shut down the physical market, so you had to hedge by going into the futures market, selling more, and it was on a Friday, so that they could then line up the margin calls on the following Monday, and so it was just crazy. Yeah. In the gold market. Meanwhile, breathlessly, the news commentators would say, GLD liquidated another 20 tons of gold this week. And I had this funny exchange. I had an exchange with Tony Deaton, who tends to keep to himself, but he gets out there a little. And he mentioned to me that he had tried to pry $60 million worth of gold out of GLD, and they wouldn't give it to him. And he says, I got a team of lawyers, and they wouldn't give it to him. And it hit me that the only people, and if you look at GLD, what it is, an ETF, and if you have a warehouse full of gold and the shares reflect the price of the gold, I can't figure out why gold should be bought and sold from that. I just think it ought to just sit there. And so the question then is, well, then who is liquidating the gold? And the answer is the 20 big ass banks.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones who can take gold from GLD. And so here's this bear raid on gold. Meanwhile, the 20 biggest banks are turning in paper promises to gold for the actual physical metal. And somehow we're told that's bearish. And that makes no sense. And every depository this year got leveled of their gold. And that somehow is supposed to be bearish. That gold went to Asia, and that's somehow supposed to be bearish, and I can't get my brain around that. So in any event, I told Grant Williams, he wrote about it, and then it went viral, right? And mm-hmm. then I asked Tony to confirm it, because he said, well, actually, it's public record in 2007. It was in a blog in 2007 that this happened. It's a funny hint about what goes on the internet. So in any event, the physical demand for gold was huge. It was undeniably huge this year, and it was all slopping to the west. I think it is my supposition that we're seeing the beginnings of a change in the currency regime. We're seeing the beginning of the dollar hegemony going away. And I think that probably the Chinese said, look, something like, this is my plot line, this is my made-for-TV movie plot line, that the Chinese said, we'll keep buying your treasuries, but you have to get us some gold, and we want it cheap, and so you sell us the gold. And so we basically shook the tree to make the gold fall out of it and go to Asia. That's my thesis, that the move of the gold to Asia and the drop in the price were a geopolitical quid pro quo.
You know, it's interesting if you follow these things, because these hints are there. So we're going to look back on this, I'm convinced, and we're going to say, how did people miss the most obvious bull market case for gold ever? Look at all the public information that was available about its flows. When we look at everything on a fundamental basis, whether that fundamental piece is around the worries around confiscation that are rightly rooted post-Cyprus, or we look at the actual flows of gold from west to east, it's just a stunning story. The only thing out of lockstep in this, of course, is price. And, I get in routine discussions, if not debates, with people who say, well, that's just sour gold bug kind of thinking. Then I wander over into, it was 2007 or 6. I remember reading a report from the Electronic Frontier Foundation that had a deposition by an AT&T engineer who said, I don't know what's going on, but I can tell you that all of our routers are compromised, that the government is siphoning all of our data. And And that was just fringe kind of stuff. And people said that's crazy talk. And then, of course, you know, you need a Snowden to come along and prove that that not only is that not crazy talk, but with every new release that comes out of the documents. And by the way, he's only released 1% of the documents he took. It just gets worse and worse. I mean, we're spying on Brazil's oil companies, Angela Merkel's phone, and other allied and affiliated leaders of the world who are presumably on our side. They're not just taking metadata. They're actually sweeping entire phone calls, you know, on and on and on and on. That was all crazy talk just a few years ago. Now people just sort of numbly look at it and say, yeah, I guess. So I'm looking at the footprints I see in the markets today, and it just basically looks like complete, utter sort of statecraft, if you will. There's so much manipulation going on. And my theory around that is kind of aligns with your gold theory, is that, look, they know that there's some really big problems in the system. That's why we still have $75 billion a month in minimum QE going on. What the Fed talks about in terms of unemployment and inflation is just for public consumption. Deep down, they're worried about something else. They see that it doesn't line up. And the markets and prices, they've learned, are really potent signaling mechanisms. And so if you had said to me, Chris, last year, I want you to script out the perfect script for the power centers, I would say, oh, well, here's what I would do with equities. Here, I would keep commodities well-contained, except for oil. We need that over 90 a barrel because fracking doesn't work otherwise. So if we want that miracle story to keep going, we're going to need to keep oil over 90. But everything else, keep the commodities down because people across the world get unhappy when their food goes up in price. We'll keep treasuries mysteriously, you know, well-bid through all of this. And, of course, gold will have to go down. That's exactly what we're seeing. And it's just, again, it could just be a coincidence, but I'm really starting to get very leery of coincidences these days.
Well, so there's a bunch of leaked memos out there that over the years surface, and the one that came out this year, and I think it was new this year, although it could be one I missed, was a 1974 Volcker memo in which he wrote about 5 or 6 pages describing the U.S.'s best interest in demonetizing gold. And he goes through country by country and says, you know, the Germans won't like this or the, you know, this and this. He goes, talks about the Arabs, and he goes on and on, but it's crystal clear that the U.S., so the dollar reserve currency has every vested interest is to keep the price of gold from getting too high. And of course, they kind of lost that battle. But the point is that I don't think gold ever lost its importance in the global currency regime. I think the United States would love it to become completely irrelevant because that means the dollar wins. But I think they got it into remission like a cancer, but it never went away. And now it's starting to surface, and now we have a problem, and we're worried about the RMB or the yuan, I never know which one to call it. Mm-hmm. We're worried about that becoming a reserve currency. I think that anyone who comes along and says our currency is gold-backed all of a sudden may own the reserve currency mm-hmm. at that point. But I think it's a battle. I think we're looking at Bretton Woods, what is it, 4-3-2-1, you know. I think we're looking at a change in the system taking place, and maybe not, but that's what I'm sensing. And that Volcker memo is worth a read. Anyone who actually goes to this review, the Volcker memo, start to finish, is a great read. It really tells you gold is important, was important, and probably will be important, and they don't want it to be important.
Well, this is the interesting part is, I'm a little torn on this, whether the West thinks it can finally just be done with gold and is perfectly happy to let the East take it, or if under the covers there aren't a whole lot of people in the West getting very concerned about where the gold is all landing. Because if we do have some sort of a currency crisis, and to me it's a question of when, not if, at this point, whether it's 20 years or 2 years, I don't know, but when we have a currency crisis, there's a very strong chance that gold is going to have a prominent role in how we start to resettle those accounts. And then it's, you know, it's going to kind of be like, who has it? And won't that be the surprise? Because India and China will have most of it at that point in time, by any measure. And I don't think that's, you know, the idea of just handing or ceding a big chunk of power to other countries is part of our plan. That doesn't make sense to me.
Well, I'm not sure the gold's coming from our sovereign stash. So if this year was about shoving gold to the east, I think it was about shoving gold to the east. It came from somewhere else, right? So the Arctic, every hint that gold was being shaken out of the system and then pushed to the east, there was no whiff of it coming out of, you know, Fort Knox or the Fed or whatever. It was coming out of other places that were not part of our sovereign stash. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that maybe we should look, we'll get someone to sell you the gold, but not us.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a Rickards model. Rickard thinks they're not going to get the gold unless they bomb us. I mean, he says, look, the Germans, when they wanted to repatriate the gold, by the way, I'm sure you've seen that great Grant Williams plot where he shows the price of gold and he indicates that where Venezuela asked for repatriated gold and the gold price went down because of that. And then the Germans asked for repatriated gold this year, which, by the way, it was hinting at last year, but finally came to pass this year. And the gold got crushed after that. And I think it's our way of getting someone else to fork up the gold to these guys, not us. Not us, the nation. Us, the, I think he wanted to get it out of the private stashes and force it by a sell-off. It kind of didn't work, in my opinion.
Well, we'll see. They had some reasonable success shaking it loose from GLD, and I'm sure from other weaker hands as well, but that's how these markets tend to work.
It's got GLD. So I don't think they shake it out of GLD. I think they're doing a Corzine MF Global on GLD. Right, so I think the removal from GLD is not about shaking it loose. I think it's about taking it, right? Because at any moment those banks can take their shares and turn them in and take the gold from GLD. And some people say GLD is being used as a fractional reserve gold banking system, which makes sense. I never trusted it. I read their prospectus. You saw that. It was so vague. It's not allocated gold. They basically said could be here, could be there, could be anywhere, go back to sleep. And it was about 5 pages long, and it was nothing. And so if there is gold in GLD, the banks can take it. So they don't need to shake it out. They can just scoop it up.
Well, it's thoroughly interesting to me that gold and trying to figure out where it's at is literally one of the most opaque subjects out there in terms of getting hard data. You can get pretty hard data about what's going on in COMEX and its inventories, but that's chump change compared to the OTC market. And then, of course, the central banks are completely opaque about what they're up to. And I've had long conversations with people who understand the actual mechanisms of gold leasing, and it turns out that it's very difficult to lease gold from central banks. They have really big 20-page contracts, and they detail every possible circumstance around it. But the number one rule is the gold doesn't actually leave anybody's vaults when they go. And so when I look at GLD, they list that the custodian for them is HSBC, and HSBC lists a sub-custodian as the Bank of England, and then you wander over and notice that Finland says, oh yeah, we have a bunch of gold, but the Bank of England has it and it's being used for something.
That's exact. But do you think the gold going to China is physically going to China? I would think so.
Oh yes, absolutely, because we had one report that the LBMA had shipped 700 tons of gold to Switzerland, and a quick phone call confirmed that all went to Swiss refiners who were turning it into 1 kilo bars.
And that all left the country.
Right. And also there was this Hong Kong Metals Exchange that got set up and then got vaporized. I have no idea what happened there, but there was a short-lived entity.
Yeah.
And presumably that somehow involved taking physical possession of physical gold. And I would have thought that the Swiss would go through the HKME and then to China. But all of a sudden, the HKME disappeared. By the way, India shut down their gold market. They completely shut it down. They shut down their gold exchange. Right? This is nutty stuff. So, in any case, the gold market's in a state of chaos. I think we're getting more questions this year than answers. But I tell you, I don't think GLD owners ought to think about that as being gold. I think at some point we're going to find out that that's an MF Global Ponzi scheme.
That's entirely possible. Of course, I've never dabbled in GLD ever, and have never recommended anybody do so. But let's talk about confusing things. Let's shift to something humorous at this point. CNBC. What a strange thing. You know, this is the part that got me about all of media. I'll put CNBC into my media bucket for a moment. So you look at something like New York Times or, you know, any of the other newspapers, and they're just hemorrhaging readers, right? And they're like, well, this is just people don't really read anymore, that the world is changing. I'm like, no, wander with me over to the internet space where there are lots and lots of readers and eyeballs and actually increasing interest. But the gap between the two is that apparently young people don't think they should pay for their propaganda. They think it should be free. And on that basis, they're not subscribing to newspapers. And it's a mystery to me when you see somebody like CNBC, they're hemorrhaging viewers. That you would think with a stock market hitting all-time new highs that the level of interest would be at all-time highs. Average retail investors have turned away. They're not interested in the story as much anymore, largely because they know that it's just big institutions, it's algorithms, it's hedge funds. It's basically just ultra-sophisticated playground at this point in time. And CNBC continues to cater to that crowd and they lose viewership, and that's not their model. And so I'm confused. How do you see that?
Well, I went on two Twitter campaigns this year.
All right.
One was to try to get CNBC to invite me to be a guest host. Uh-huh. That was obviously a 0% probability, but I started harassing them and saying, come on, I will speak for Joe Sixpack, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I can do it. Just yeah. I'll give you my resume. I'll tell you what I've done. I want to be on your show. And I just got nothing, zero.
Uh-huh.
But the second campaign I went on was to challenge them on reporting earnings X items, which are just, that's just pro forma earnings. That's just a bald-faced lie. That there's just nothing honest about X items earnings. And I challenge a bunch of them on Twitter saying, why don't you say what are the items and how much are they when you're talking to these guys? And I got answers like, well, you know, our traders want those numbers. They'd say, we don't have time. That was another great answer.
Mm-hmm.
And I got lots of, there's others, we talk about that a lot. It's like, oh, that's a lot of action. So the bottom line is that it seems as though that they want to present the X items earnings because people are trading off it, but the 20 million viewers that they could have or should have or did have, whatever it is, they're not the traders trading off it. So CNBC's completely missing the point. The people who buy the products on their commercials, they want honest numbers. They don't want fake numbers. And they're trying to get it better. Like Kernan, for example, who was a waste of oxygen for a long time, is now starting to realize that the central banks are a problem and starting to realize that rigged markets are a problem. You can hear it. He's getting better.
Mm-hmm.
And they seem to realize that the masses who are supposed to be paying their bills don't like the garbage. So maybe they'll figure it out. And then CNBC will become an honest source of news again.
Hmm.
See the Leisman, the Steve Leisman, Jim Grant debate the other morning? That was spectacular. Yeah, Grant took Leisman right to the mat.
Yeah.
That's, you know, Steve, the great line was, I can listen to you from my bed. Now it's time for you to let me talk. I've never seen Jim Grant irritated.
I know.
He was irritated. So that's what CNBC's facing now.
For a guy with a bow tie, he certainly took it to him. Yeah, he must have got up early, but he had a lot of good points to make. And I think he's channeling. I wish you had gotten on, because it really needs to be said much more directly, which is we are just tired of all the lies and all the spins and all the distortions that seem to serve everybody but the majority of people, you know.
Do they listen to your podcast? So it's a standing offer. I will guest host. I will drive down there. All expenses paid by me. I want to be on your show. How's that, guys? If you hear me, invite me down. You can get my email. I'm not holding my breath, by the way, just for the record. I don't think they'll give me 2 minutes, let alone guest host, but...
I know. So in the time we have left, I'm interested now, you know, we look at this summary of things, we see, you know, there is a bear case to be made on a number of fundamental areas, but fundamentals don't seem to matter really at this point in the prices of things. And that's to be expected when you have the price of money itself distorted. Guess what? it turns out everything gets distorted. So here we are in our hall of mirrors. We've got debt still increasing at extraordinary rates. The housing market is not recovered in anything except at the institutional Blackstone sort of a level. We've got just bizarre things going on at the federal government level with the government just seemingly unaware of any sense of limits. All of that, you put all of that into your magic year-end review and you peer forward. What do you see coming?
Okay, so to me, this year was about civil liberties, and it just dominated my field of view. We didn't really talk about it. You kind of touched upon Snowden, but there were all sorts of breaches of civil liberties this year, all sorts of warning shots that say that it's problematic. You mentioned Snowden. You can track concerns about the NSA's potential to go totalitarian, those kind of words, to 1975, Frank Church, Senator Frank Church. And there have been whistleblowers all along saying these guys are dangerous, and then all of a sudden somehow Snowden clicked, but he was not the first. So civil liberties is a huge issue. Is, you know, they've got facial recognition software to make your shopping experience better, right? It's like, I don't want my shopping experience being approved by face recognition software, right? We're at great risk of going Orwellian here. And this really came through clear this year. The debt just keeps getting worse. We just keep going bananas on the debt. And you know, these guys, they go on TV and they say, we got to get the consumer consuming. The consumer has no money. It's that simple. The consumer is out of money. The student debt is soaring because the parents are broke. We've got an entire generation that's being damaged daily by opportunities that don't exist, that they were promised, right? And this is scarring. And then the markets look broken to me. They're so state controlled. And anyone who says that's a conspiracy theory, well then, excuse me, what's QE? Right? If the markets aren't rigged, then what's QE? What's 0% interest rates? What is that? And so I think broken markets, civil liberties, state capitalism, that's the plowing. Meanwhile, because the Dow's up, everyone's partying. But since the numbers are so bogus, we know we're going to get a regression of the mean. History of bear markets show three big legs down. We've only had two. The next one will rip the souls out of investors if it shows up. And the markets, the economy's immunocompromised. We're fragile. We get hit with another Lehman-type phase. We're going to really crumble this time. We're really going to have a mess on our hands. So, and I think it could come. So my advice is buy physical gold. I have not lost my enthusiasm for physical gold. That's my take.
All right. Well, it's certainly a take that conforms with mine at this point in time. I've become just absolutely convinced that what the Fed has managed to do is secure the price of everything, but really understands the value of nothing. And we look at all of the structural weaknesses that existed and all of the structural issues that were there in 2008. I actually score most of them as worse now, not better. And I think the markets are hopelessly addicted to Fed stimulus. I think the federal government could not operate without the Fed buying its debt. I am absolutely astonished that the world has just sort of yawned and said, that's fine, you guys go ahead and monetize your debt. I will note that emerging economies have been just soundly spanked for similar behaviors in the past. Really just horribly, abused their currencies, their debt markets, and, IMF forcing them to cough up private assets, utilities, phones, things like that, because they've tried to engage in this behavior. Somehow the U.S. gets away with it. Japan gets away with it. The ECB is carting a slightly different path. But at the same time, this is all just, it's fake. It's just as fake as can be. But I don't think they know what else to do at this point besides do more of the same. And the only thing that really annoys me about this, because I'm perfectly happy to sit back and watch it happen. I've got myself squared away and I'm pretty happy with where I sit in life at this point around all of this. But the part that does still get under my skin is watching the apologists who come out and try and make sense of it and squeeze it through distorted practices and filters. Paul Krugman is sort of my poster child for this this behavior. And it's a
catchphrase that I use throughout, and I finally ended up saying, I'll just put it in the title of my year in review, is that austerity is not a policy. Austerity is a consequence of bad policies. And when we were talking about saving Europe and that austerity was a bad idea, I'm going, what about austerity as a policy?
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's what happens when you pull demand forward. That's what happens when you spend yourself into oblivion. Now it's time to pay the piper, right? This is it. Now we get to deal with the fact that the average boomer has $70,000 saved. That's it. It's game over. It's tilt. There is no austerity policy left. There's just austerity.
Yep. Well, that's ultimately where I see us going, and you know, this is the part that mystifies me, is when I peer forward 30 years, I can clearly see that I'm very happy going out on this limb, because it's fat, that we're going to have to deal with things like you just said, the entitlement programs, and the fact that the average boomers who are retiring at the rate of 10,000 a day at this particular part of the boomer bulge are heading into that retirement woefully unprepared. And then I wander over and I look at a 30-year treasury bond selling at the prices they're selling at. And I'm like, who could possibly buy those at that price? Except somebody who thinks that they'll be able to sell out of that when that turns out to be a bad deal.
Right. Well, the bond market's going to take the bond investors are going to be taken out on boards by the time this is over. They're just not going to survive. It might be slow, but it'll be a fatality for serious bonds. And Ray Dalio said the way you deal with the bond market is you use leverage. I'm going, are you kidding me? You're telling us to lever up in bonds right now? I used to give him credit, but that's a scary one.
Maybe he's got a lot of bonds to sell. So, that...
Well, he's got a Fed to buy them, so I don't know what the problem would be.
Well... All right. Well, Dave, thanks so much for your time today. This is all the time we've got. I really want to encourage people to read your full report. It does take some time to get through, but it's just beautifully referenced, and I love your witty style in there, and it's just a clean summary. And I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to really dive into civil liberties, because that is a really actually very hot topic for myself, because I do believe that a wealth of a nation comes from having free citizens who are capable of making their own decisions, operating with what they believe to be fairly enforced laws and rules, and that their privacy and patent protections will be honored. And I do think that a robust middle class is a key to prosperity of a nation. And all of these things have really taken hits this year, big time. So wish we could have gone into that more. But if people read your year-end in review, and then we can talk about it in the comments underneath.
You betcha.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your time today, and we'll see you in the comments section.
You bet.
All right.